G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another installment of your favourite podcast, The U Project. Tiffany Ann Cook over there at TYP Central.
Craig,
not representing at all. Not representing at all.
Every inch of my screen's covered in a roll with the punches crap.
I know. What is that? What is that about? How's your morning been?
It's really good. I just finished crawling around my studio doing some of my crazy zoo stuff that you still haven't jumped in on.
Well, that's because my body is fucked. And if I do your zoo workout, I'm going to be in traction for 3 weeks and eating Voltaren sandwiches till Christmas. So me doing a zoo workout is not happening, but thanks for the invitation. Peter Baines, are you much of an athlete? Do you work out, mate?
I wouldn't call myself an athlete, but I run a fair bit. So I don't know when you change from a jogger to a runner to an athlete, but I'm probably at the beginning of all of that.
How long have you been like a lifelong runner, or is it a new thing? Firstly, welcome to the U Project. You're here. Have you been a lifelong runner, or is it newish?
I do a lot of bike riding, and I don't know what it was, but a little while ago, maybe a couple of years ago, I kind of fell out of love with riding my bike, and so started running and found trail running, and do a couple of ultra marathons each year up in the Blue Mountains, and this year signed up for the 100K UTA. So now just focusing on training for that. And not a lifelong runner, but just something I seem to enjoy at the moment.
You know, Tiff, that someone's a high performer when they go do a bit of running, do a couple of ultra marathons a year, like, fuck off, you fucking bit of running. Fucking hell. Oh, a bit of running, couple of ultra marathons, just signed up for 100K.
You see, an ultra, like it's a legitimate way of being in the bush and walking. So it's, like once you're out of sight and there's no one around, well, you just walk. And it's a beautiful way to be in the bush and have time out.
What's your, what's the longest one you've done? Are they all around 100-ish, or what's the range?
No, most of them, certainly in Australia, I've done New Zealand as well. They are normally with the 50K, then 100K, then 100 miler, so 160. And I've just progressing up to my first 100. So at the moment, I've only done 50Ks, but that keeps me out in the bush on the trail for about 8 hours at a time. And with the trail run, you know, there's lots of elevation, so it's different than a road marathon where you're just paving the pavement for 4 hours or so. With an ultra, you might do 4,000 meters of vertical climbing over 50Ks, which is pretty intense.
Oh yeah, it's a completely different experience. And I mean, running 50Ks of trails where it's uneven surfaces, you're moving in different directions, you're not running in a straight line, and you're negotiating terrain. And as you said, there's that elevation component. That's probably 50Ks of that is almost worth 100Ks of running around suburbia. Can I be really rude? I'm just curious. How old are you?
54.
How's your body?
It's all right. Like it's touch wood. There's no problems with like recovery from running or anything like that. And have a really low resting heart rate, and had a medical the other week, and doctor was really happy with blood pressure and all that kind of stuff. So at the moment, I seem to be going all right for 54, I think, mate.
Yeah. If you're any more laid back, you'd be in a coma, but that's good. that's good. He's not dying of a stress-related illness anytime soon, Tiff. I was going to ask him at some stage about PTSD with all the shit he's been through, but I don't think that's relevant, but maybe we'll find out it is at some stage. What did you think you were going to be, Peter, when you were growing up?
I never really had any firm ideas. I guess the best way to answer that, well, what did I do for work experience when I had a choice? And I worked at Lane Cove National Park with the rangers in Sydney, and that was always something that appealed to me, but never went there, left school without any real focus of what to do or where I wanted to be. I got enough marks to go to uni, so I rolled in uni and very quickly realised there was no direction there. I had no idea what I was doing. I was studying a Bachelor of Attendance or Bachelor of Arts and pulled out of that. And not long after, enrolled to join the cops, and that was where I spent the next 20-odd years.
What led you to join the cops? Was it just a door opened or there was an introduction? Did you have a passion for it, or was it more just fortuitous? You fell into it?
Yeah, no, I guess it was just something that, at the time after leaving uni, I was working at Grace Brothers, which the kids wouldn't know anymore, but now it's known as Myers, a real retail store, and yep. Just working as a sales assistant there and saw a couple of, blokes in uniform and just went, oh, that might be all right. And applied. And at the time, it was normally like a 3-year wait from application till if you're accepted to go to the academy. But I got in pretty quickly for whatever reason. And it was only like a process was less than 12 months when I was down at Goulburn. It wasn't an ambition. It was just something that seemed to make sense and just followed the path.
Mm. What percentage of the this is a complete ridiculous question because there's no absolute answer, but it's a guesstimation. I reckon you'd have a pretty good idea. What percentage of the population do you reckon would be suited to policing? Because I don't think the percentage is huge, but I could be wrong.
You know, I reckon there's those that make turn out to be really good coppers are those who I reckon are on the edge of either being in the cops or being in the back of the police truck, on their way into the cells, It used to be like back in the 70s and 80s and so forth, you had a trade and that got you into the cops. And then now it's, you've got to have graduated from uni with some type of either Bachelor of Policing or whatever. And I reckon it's always been a type of job that those that are best suited have a level of maturity, knockabout, and can relate to, a good cross-section of people. And it's certainly changed, who's attracted to it now, I guess, or the requirements. But, one of the great things about being, in the police is there's so much diversity around what you can do. You know, the opportunities once you're in to specialise in all different areas. And I saw that change where then to specialise, then you needed to do, another 3 or 4 years study at university in your specialty area. So that kind of locked you into different areas. There's so much scope. And, I had a great time and, had a lot of experiences that you'd never expect and international travel and what it delivered me. Was probably outside of the norm, but it was a great career and I'd have no hesitation in recommending it if my kids wanted to go down that path. It's, I think it offers a lot.
So you ended up, and there's a lot of steps between where you started, but you ended up doing forensic or being a forensic investigator. But where did you start in the cops? What was your first job? What did you love? What did you hate? And why did you end up and how did you end up where you did doing what you did?
Yes, I left Goulburn Academy in 86 and was posted to Marylands Police Station, which is in the western suburbs of Sydney near Parramatta. And at the time, it was seriously a retirement village, like we
perfect.
We used to work, not for a young bloke, Craig. We used to work three shifts at the time. It was either 7 a.m. till 3, 3 to 11 or 11 to 7. And at the time, Wentworthville Police Station was only a 18-hour police station. And Marylands would cover that area as well. And anyone knows those areas I'm talking about now, you just wouldn't believe what it was like compared to what it is now. And now it's certainly a high crime area, but we could do a night shift and you could have be in the police station from 11 till 7 and not have a phone call, not have a job. And you drive around just trying to find something to do to keep yourself awake, you know. And I did that for 18 months. And as a young bloke, I was just going, you know, there's got to be more to this. So I applied for a transfer and went to Cabramatta, and which is not too far away from Merrylands, but it could have been a different world, you know. Like Cabramatta in the late 80s had the highest crime rate, or the highest homicide rate in Australia. And wow. There was a wars that was going on between the drug gangs, the Banana Gang and the 5T Gang, and a huge import of heroin from the Romanians and distribution on the streets by the Vietnamese. And you know, you'd turn up there for your shift, and more times than not, you'd be handed a list of outstanding jobs by the car crew that you were replacing. And you could finish your shift, and with all the new incoming jobs, you still wouldn't have got to the jobs that you'd been handed off. You know, like we used to work at the time, you'd do an afternoon shift and a night shift, and there'd be four of you. There'd be two in the car and two in the station. And again, now, like you look at the policing levels out there, and it's just such a different place. And Cabramatta is a very different place as well. But, you know, as a young bloke, going to a busy station was, you know, you work hard, you play hard, and you know, you learn hard. You know, the no better place to learn than when you're in the real thick of it and you're busy and made the time go well. And I enjoyed that. But the big problem, Craig, was next to the police station. And when I say next to, I mean directly next to, was the Cabra Vale Diggers Club. And what would happen on a Friday night, they would have a disco. And the disco would close the doors at 3 o'clock in the morning, and the bouncers would push everyone out the door well before responsible services of alcohol was something that we knew about. And then what would happen is the drunks would walk out of the police station, out of the Cabra Vale club there, and they would see that blue sign that said police. And for them, that was interpreted to, I can go there to use the toilets, I can go there to get a lift home, I can go there to order a taxi, I can go there to order a kebab. And, you know, you're sitting there in the police station, it's the second night of night shift, you're exhausted, all you want to do is be in bed, and you've got all of these fucking drunks just walking in. And, you know, it got to the point where after a couple of years at Cabramatta, I just got sick of dealing with drunks. And I got sick of dealing with domestics. You know, like I was a young bloke who, you know, at the age of 21 or so forth, you're the senior man on the truck, and you're turning up to domestics where people have been married longer than you've been alive. And you're called in to try and sort these issues out, you know. And I just got sick of the, as I say, the domestics and the drunks, and went, there's got to be something else. There was an opportunity to join the crime scene unit, which is a forensic services group. And I thought, I'll give that a go, you know. And I'd always been interested in major crime and found the investigation of death interesting, and started there. And that became the career within the career. You know, I'd go on and study science at university. I'd do a law degree. That became an incredibly rewarding place to work.
You would have to have an innately curious mind, I would think. You would need, I mean, like I listened to you have a bit of a chat with Tiff, and I was thinking about the skills and the attributes that you would need to deal with the shit that you dealt with, which was, for most people, would be extremely confronting and uncomfortable, but also to be able to self-manage in the moment and be clear and calm and effective. Is that innate in you, or was that developed?
I'm not sure, mate. It's probably a bit of both. You know, it's probably more comes with the experience of, you know, arriving. And I think, you know, probably the thing you touch on there, the greatest skill, was to turn up at a highly charged and emotional scene where you could have the, you know, the bodies of a number of people. It could have been a multiple homicide or so forth. And you're called out. And from the minute that you arrive, it's then your scene. you're in control. And, you know, there'd be a lot of people there and a lot of cops and people wanting answers, people wanting results, people wanting them, you know, do different things, people wanting to enter the scene. And your role was to take control of the scene. And until you handed it over, you were responsible. And I think the key thing was as you got more experience within that role, it was the turning up and being calm, because, you know, you rush into those type of things, you get caught up in other people's emotions, and then you start to make mistakes, you start to miss things, and you start to rush. And, you know, by the time we turn up at a scene, we're not saving lives. You know, anyone who's there at the scene when we arrive as a victim, sadly, is dead. And, you know, we can't help them. The best thing that we can do is do our job to the best of the ability and present that evidence to the court, whether it be a criminal jurisdiction, whether it be the coronial investigation or whatever it is. So I think, you know, with experience, you just got to the point where you're able just to control your emotions and focus on the job at hand, knowing the best thing you could do for the families was to be the best at your job.
How did you control your emotions?
Well, I think part of it is, and it's, you know, something I can answer that question more on reflection than at the time. One is, you know, in a contextual level, it's having a real clarity of purpose. So understanding why you do what you do. And for me, when I reflect back on the 20 odd years that I was in the police and the work that I do now, it's about providing answers. Now, the questions are different to what I do now and to what I used to do, but it's the same thing. We're providing answers to the questions that are presented to us. And I think the, you know, like some of the international work that I would do in towards the latter end of my career, you know, to answer the question around controlling your emotions, I'd say that, you know, the toughest part of your job was dealing with the relatives. The most rewarding part of your job was dealing with the relatives, you know, and, you know, working in, you know, some pretty big disaster and crisis situations where, you know, the deaths were in the thousands, you know, not hundreds, but thousands of bodies that were before us. And, you know, you had to find a balance of, you know, when I worked in Thailand after the tsunami and we were moving the bodies, we had 3,500 bodies at one site. And you had the bodies of kids, you had the bodies of mums and dads and brothers and sisters. And, you know, we would spend the day and just surrounded by death. And you can't become attached and understand the story and want to, you know, have a special moment with everybody, because you're you know, your time, your capacity to remain in a place like that quickly comes to an end. But you also have to find the balance where you know that those kids that you're carrying around that site, the bodies you're doing postmortems on, are someone's loved one. And if you lose that context, well, then you become less effective. So it really is finding a balance between not caring too much, but not, you know, making sure that you care enough.
So interesting. So, because before you spoke about attachment, and I wrote down here as you started to talk, I wrote empathy and I wrote dichotomy, which is like there's this almost opposing constructs of empathy, because you need empathy because you've got to care and have awareness, but you also need detachment. And they're almost the opposite, but you need to have both in that moment, that you care, but also that you don't get overwhelmed by what you're in the middle of.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that balance, and it's something that you have to almost feel and find. Like if I was talking to someone thinking about entering that area, it's not as though you can say, this is the percentage or this is the quantum of empathy or disengagement. You know, it's something that you just have to arrive at. And, but I think it's those who have the best of that, have the longest and most successful tenure within those areas. You know, it's a you've spoken about PTSD, and it's one of the four high risk areas within the police PTSD. And there's a question, you know, around, well, how long can you work in that area? How long is it appropriate to let people remain in that area? But, you know, do you mitigate their exposure by saying, well, after, you know, 5 years of working in that area, you should be transferred out? And I go, well, you know, you're not accepted by the courts as an expert witness in these areas until you've got 5 years experience. You know, you study at university for 4 years studying forensic science. So to remove people at the 5 year mark, you're just hitting your straps.
Yeah.
You know, like if your mum or your daughter or your brother or your husband is the subject of a violent crime and you know, is a victim of a homicide, do you want cops who have got 2 years experience, or do you want those turning up who have got 20 years experience to be leading the investigation into your loved one? Well, of course, it's the latter. But how do you find the balance as an organisation to mitigate the exposure? And a big part of that comes down to the individual. And, you know, I've spoken a lot about it, been asked a lot about it. And, you know, I think there's a number of things that need to be going well in your life and how you manage that to have that survivorship in that role. But it is the balance, as you said.
And I think also with everything, Peter, and obviously your job is at the far end of the scale in terms of, you know, stress, etc. But I think all jobs or all roles have a used by date. You know, even I've had multiple jobs and multiple businesses and multiple, I guess you could almost say, careers, because either you get to the point where it doesn't stimulate you anymore, or you don't enjoy it, or it creates more problems than solutions for you, or you get to the point where you almost hate a thing that you once really loved because you've just done too much of it and you've been overexposed to whatever it is. I mean, I worked in fitness from when I was 18, and I sold my last gym. I got out of my last gym 7 years ago, and I loved it. I love training people. I love working with athletes. I love, you know, fitness, exercise, physio, all of that. But you get to the point where you go, no, that's enough now. I don't want to talk about bums and legs and micros and macros and, you know, progressive overload anymore. I need to do something different. So what was the thing that you did when you first came out of the police force? What was the next step?
Yeah, I guess for me, the transition, and just to reflect on what you said there, you know, what I around like a natural ending, and like I left as the state operations coordinator for the forensic services group within New South Wales Police. So I was a detective inspector, and you know, had the bulk of my time within the police in that area, and I saw a lot go off with PTSD and various degrees of it. And I tell you, mate, you know, where I think if my opinion counted towards anything, I reckon the biggest problem was that when the guys got to a point, either through choice or through ability, they'd reached their final point of promotion. And so where they were, whatever level that was, either through choice of, I don't want to go back to Sydney, I don't want to move my family, or, you know, they've tapped out with their potential and ability, is that they then look down the barrel and they see another 10 or 15 years of doing what they're currently doing. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that I feel like I came out of it okay of, you know, with the work that I did for, you know, quite a long time, was because my role within the forensic services group, it changed every couple of years. Yeah. And it was, you know, I went from Sydney to Tamworth and then had 10 years in Tamworth. But even when I was at Tamworth, you know, I changed and got promoted to a detective sergeant there. Then I came back to Sydney as an inspector looking after half of Sydney, then into an ops role. And then, you know, the international work. And then I took a secondment with Interpol. And so there was this continual change. And I think the guys that struggled, and, you know, when you talk about the end of your career, I think it's when you, all of those things you said resonate. And I think it's when you can't see change and you can't see growth within you. But, you know, for me, what did I do when I left? Well, I spent, you know, 2002, I was part of the leadership team in Bali after the bombings, doing the identification of the victims there. 2005, I spent most of the year in Thailand leading the Australian team and international response into the identification of the 5,395 bodies that we recovered there. And when I wasn't deployed into Thailand, I was coordinating the deployment of future teams from New South Wales. In 2006 and 2007 through 2008, I worked on an international secondment with Interpol in Lyon in France on a counterterrorism project. And then I, that was extended a couple of times, ended up working in a capacity building role for the UN Office of Drug and Crime throughout Southeast Asia. Then at the end of all of that, New South Wales Police was still paying me while I was on this comment. And it was only supposed to be 12 months and it went on for a couple of years. And then I got a phone call and said, you've got to come back to work, have a meeting. And they said, okay, we need to wrap up this comment. We've been paying you for a couple of years and we haven't seen you. We want you back. Where do you want to work within New South Wales Police? They're kind of like, well, let's find you a job back in the place that's paying you. And by that stage, I'd started a charity in 2006 to support kids in Thailand who had been left without a family to care for them after the tsunami. And that charity took off through 2007, 2008. And I was making a lot of money for that charity by speaking at conferences and for businesses around leadership and so forth. And you know, that speaking was taking me across the world, delivering keynote presentations, and the funds that were coming from that were going into the charity. And when I had the conversation with the police, with my former assistant commissioner, she said to me, where do you want to go? And I said, I want to take 12 months leave without pay so I can focus on the charity. And I said to her, I feel as if it's just in those formative stages. If I come back to work, I won't have the capacity to do what I'm doing to get the charity cemented, and the kids, there's a reliance. I said, so I just want 12 months leave without pay so I can focus on this. And she said, well, I'm not going to support you in that. And I said, okay. So I took a couple of weeks holiday and decided there and then I'd resign. And you know, had a really senior position, got promoted incredibly young or very early in my career. You know, I just went, the real feeling was if I went back to the police, and the trouble too, Craig, was I'd now spent, you know, a good part of the last, from 2002, 2005, 7 and 8, working on international projects, you know, and the work we did in Thailand was thousands bigger than 9/11 in relation to the number of bodies, you know, I was leading an international site. You know, I was working for Interpol on, you know, CBRN, which is chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear threats. You know, I was writing a paper for the member countries of Interpol around counterterrorism. And then when New South Wales Police said, would you come back? I went, you know, a big part of it was, where am I going to find motivation? You know, how am I going to go back into meetings that I used to sit in where we got people complaining about having a 15-inch monitor instead of a 17-inch monitor? How can I find that stimulation again of what I used to do now when I've worked on this, you know, such a high level? And I guess from a sporting analogy, it'd be like, you know, representing Australia or playing high-level AFL or NRL and then being told, okay, you've got to go back and play park footy on a Saturday.
Mm.
How do you turn up for training being motivated for that?
Yeah.
And for me, that was where I went, okay, well, I'll leave, let someone else, you know, step up and they can do what I'm doing and, you know, I'll pursue something else.
Well, you kind of, and this is not an ego thing or an arrogance thing, but I think you outgrow stuff, you know, and it's like you got outside the box outside all the boxes, and then they wanted to bring you back within the box. And I completely understand their motivation, because you're a valuable asset and they want you in, not out. She probably realized that if you spend another year out just doing your own thing, you'd never come back. So I don't blame her, but also I understand you. And I think that, I mean, and this is for anyone, I think, irrespective of your job or your career or your role or your position, if there's not a lot of fulfillment or potential for growth or learning or stimulation or joy, or then fuck, life's horrible. I mean, because you're doing that, you know, you're suiting up every day to do something that gives you no joy or pleasure or purpose or fulfillment, then before long, you're going to be anxious and depressed and you're going to be struggling to get out of bed. So,
And I tell you what, mate, like the cops is full of disgruntled people who have been there for 25 years don't recognize the skills that they have, or feel locked into this is all they've got, and they see that they've got to wait the next 10 years before they can retire, you know, and it's a depressing place to be, working with people who have that mindset. But when you said, did I outgrow it or whatever, it's funny, the day that I finished with New South Wales Police before I started the secondment, which was only supposed to be 12 months, that evening I was speaking for graduates of the Reserve Bank, and at a beautiful property they own at Kirribilli. And I arrived a little bit early, and I was standing waiting to go in and looking across to the Opera House, and it's a really clear moment for me. And and I reflected that day, and I went, I wonder if I've just done the last day within the cops.
Mm.
And as it turned out, I had, you know, because I never went back. And and I think, you know, early on within my secondment, I was starting to go, well, what else, where do I go? And probably the natural transition would have been to like a senior role within the AFP or something like that. But, you know, at the end of the secondment, and, you know, when the decision came to it, you know, like I'd studied and graduated law, and, you know, I thought, well, I'll go and, you know, practice law, having spent all this time within the forensic services group and having that intimate knowledge of forensic science related to major crime. And then, you know, where I graduated from that and went, I don't think I'll do that either, you know, and just kind of rolled with it. And, you know, here I am, however many years on from, you know, leaving the cops and loving life.
Have you got kids, mate?
Yeah, three kids. 27, 25 and 23-year-olds. Lockie's my oldest, Kelse my daughter is in the middle, and Jack's my youngest.
And did you, when you're in the middle of it, in the middle of the mayhem and the dealing with all the hard stuff and at the coal face, how would you come home and switch off and go, ta-da, give us a cuddle, let's kick the footy, let's fuck around, let's throw the frisbee and be present and be loving and be a great dad and husband and all that? Like, was that a challenge?
Maybe a question best answered by the kids, you know, but, you know, when they were all born in Tamworth, and when I went to Tamworth, I used to work 7 days on, 4 days 7 days on call, and then you'd have 3 days in the office, 4 days off, and then you'd be back on call again. So call meant that you'd rock up at the office at 7 a.m. On the Monday morning, you'd be handed the keys to the car and the work phone, and that was yours for 7 days. And when a job came in, whether it was 10 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning, you'd then respond. And the area that we service from Tamworth was the top of the Great Dividing Range, you know, through some pretty wild country up through east of places called Nowandock and right up through to the Queensland border, then as far west out through the Pilliga scrub. And you know, and on it wouldn't be unusual that you could do 1,000 kilometres a day driving and attend two scenes. You know, you might get called out in the morning for a job at Moree, which is 600 k's return trip. You get home in the afternoon, having spent a day digging out the scene of a fire, for example, establishing a cause and origin, get home, sit down for dinner, and then you get a phone call that there's been a suicide up at Glen Innes or Inverell or Tenerfield. You know, there's another 400 or 500 k's return trip, and you're on call for the week. So the absence from the family was something that they just grew up knowing that was life, you know, and it wasn't as though any of that was planned, you know, like you get the phone call and it's not, well, can you come up tomorrow? It's, we'll stand here and preserve the scene until you get here. So, you know, you walk out of this kid's school play, you leave whatever's going on, you finish dinner, you have a shower, get changed into your work kit and away you go. And that was life. And, you know, I think, you know, the work I did internationally was different, where, you know, I went away for weeks and then months at a time. And that became hard for the kids. And you know, it really, that was a significant turning point in my life was, you know, and again, on reflection, the day of the Boxing Day tsunami, you know, like we learned about it through it was the news broke on during the cricket, during the test match, you know. And
I remember.
And we were away with family. My family was away with a heap of friends, and we were down at a place called Sussex Inlet on the south coast of New South Wales on holidays. And the day all the parents stood around the evening news, stood around the telly watching the evening news at 6 o'clock because, you know, we all realised it was something pretty big. And my wife was on the other side of the room. And as we saw the scale grow on the news, we made eye contact, and without speaking, we knew what that meant. And it was only, you know, a short time before I'd get a phone call and be told to finish my holidays, head back to Sydney, and I'd be on a plane. And you know, there's not one thing that remained consistent in my life. From the day that I left for Thailand apart, the fact I had three kids, you know, like there's nothing that remained the same after that event. And, you know, it's a journey that the kids went through.
What changed, mate? I'm sure a million things, and that's a naive and dumb question, but, you know, what are some of the key and core things that changed or changed you, obviously being in the middle of that experience, obviously, but what changed in terms of how you operate and how you see the world and your life?
Like the biggest change was, you know, after my second tour, my marriage had fallen apart, you know, and my wife said to me, and it was such a strange thing, Craig, you know, we'd spoken about it and speaking to other cops or other forensic police and so forth who were over in Thailand, and it became this thing where you never did more than it was unusual to do more than one tour because of the exposure. And I did multiple and had to have psych evals to go and all of that kind of stuff. But I was sitting in a senior role leading the Australian team, and the executive committee who were leading Thailand, there was a decision made early on that for a senior role, you couldn't go unless you'd already been there before, because what was happening is that, you know, if you came over to replace me and it was your first tour and you were the site commander and you were coming from Sweden, for example, well, the first thing you wanted to do when you took on this new role was bring about change, you know, stamp your leave your mark. And then you'd be there for a month, then someone else would come in, someone from Germany or England or whatever, and they'd want to change it. And you know, what we were doing wasn't wrong. What they were implementing wasn't wrong, but we didn't need change. So no. The executive committee made a decision that the only people who could come back in these very senior roles were people who had been there before. And I was one of them, so I kept going. But so what was I saying? Yeah, the first tour that I went, you know, I spoke to my wife every day and it was incredibly supportive. And that was my job. You know, I got home and she said, I'm really proud of you. And if the opportunity comes to go again, we'll go again, you know. And I went the second time and we fought almost every day on the phone.
Wow.
And for some unknown reason. And we've spoken and reflected upon this. And she said, you know, she said, there'd be days where I'd get off the phone and I'd pick a fight with you for no reason. You hadn't done anything wrong. And she said, I'd always wanted to ring back and apologize. And I never did. And, you know, and one day she said to me, you have to make a choice. And I was over there amongst it all. And she said, yeah, I've got to make a choice. Either do what you do or you have a family. You can't do both anymore, you know. And, you know, different things, you know, happened and, you know, ended up moving out of home and living on a couch and just kept going backwards and forwards. And that was the biggest change for me, undoubtedly, and the impact it had on my kids. And you know, I was at the lowest point of my life after my last tour. You know, like I returned to Sydney. And the Thai government had asked me to go back and live and work on Phi Island for 3 months. And what had happened is the seawall had collapsed as a result of the tsunami. And there wasn't a lot of work done on Phi Island. And the bodies were recovered and were taken to Krabi. And then from then into the process, we were doing it. But there wasn't a lot of work done on Phi Island. And we went over there in August and flew over on a heli, and you know, those local operators on Phi Island were trying to get business and life back together, trying to get tourists back together, and having us walk around with shovels in police uniform looking for bodies that had never been recovered, it's not a great thing for tourism, you know.
Yeah.
And, so we weren't particularly well received or wanted on Phi Island, but the Thai government, they asked me to return, live on the island for 3 months and lead a project, which was the excavation of this seawall that collapsed, and to either find and locate bodies that were missing or confirm that they weren't there. And that request was put to the New South Wales Police. And again, my commander, who didn't give me the approval to have the time off, she said, no, I'm not approving you to go back there. And so when I went back after that tour, I knew that that was my last tour because, you know, I wouldn't be supported to go again. And it had already been, the request from the Thai government had already been turned down. So, and I arrived back into Sydney and got my kit bag off the carousel, and I stood there and I went, well, where do I go? You know, it was the first time certainly my adult life or my life, I was not to make it sound dramatic, but I was kind of homeless, you know, like yeah. I'd been trying to rent a house while I was in Thailand, knowing what I was coming back to. You know, no real estate would let me rent a place without having seen it. And so I got off this plane after having just completed another tour of Thailand and stood there and went, well, you know, where do I go?
Yeah.
And caught a taxi out to Parramatta Police Headquarters and picked up my work car because I was issued with an unmarked work car. And, you know, and I lived in a hostel for a while, like everything that I needed, which was police uniforms and all my stuff, was in the boot of the police car. And because I had no money, you know, like I'd separated from my wife. My kids were at private school. Cops don't get paid much. Had a mortgage to pay and had no money to live on myself. And it was pretty tough there for a while. And, you know, I reflect on that time and I go, it was the lowest point of my life, you know, emotionally. I was pretty broken, mentally I was exhausted, financially couldn't have been in a worse position, and you know, physically just kind of spent as well. But something interesting happened. You know, I had a conversation with a colleague of mine who was working with me as part of the team I was running at one of the sites, and she was from the UK, and she said, you know, those kids that we met in Thailand, they were living in a tent. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, they need a home. And do you want to join me in raising some money to build these kids a home? You know, and at the time, as I said, like I had, by this stage, I'd, you know, rented a place and scraped some money together. And I was living on, once I paid the rent and the mortgage and everything else, I had $80 a fortnight to feed the kids and live on. So fuck all money, you know. And here I am, I've got this colleague of mine saying, do you want to support some kids in Thailand? I go, I wouldn't mind supporting my own fucking kids, you know, let alone supporting these other kids. And but something really interesting happened. The day that I, you know, made a, you know, full commitment and all in, boots and all in, to support these kids of Thailand, my life turned around, you know, and, you know, and my life became richer on every measure from that decision. You know, like I would go on and little did I know at the time, we started the charity, you know, Hands Across the Water, and I focused on raising money because, you know, you split the sheets with your partner and your social network splits in half as well. You know, people decide, are they with you or against you? And you know, I'd never raised money for a charity before. I'd worked at a food van, you know, feeding the homeless of a night, but I'd never, you know, never raised money. I thought, how am I going to do this? And we're talking about significant coin here to build a home for these 30 odd kids. And I'd been asked before I went on my last tour, was I interested in this public speaking business? You know, and the bloke that invited me to join was through a mutual friend, and he said, you know, if you can tell a story, you certainly got a story. If you can tell it, you can make some money. And he gave me his business card, and I walked away from that lunch and thought, this bloke's full of shit. I dropped the business card in the bin, and I thought, what could I possibly have to offer anyone other than, you know, I'm in the cops. What value do I have? You know,
such a dumbass. For such a smart bloke, you were a dumbass in that moment, weren't you?
Oh, well, mate, it was just where I was. And you know, then when I got the phone, I thought, well, how am I going to raise this money? And I thought, if half of what Matt said to me is true, I'll give that a crack. So I found his contact details and I got back onto him and I said, Matt, do you think what you said, is that, you reckon that's true? And he said, well, the only way to find out is to go and test it. And I thought, well, if half of what he said about, you know, the type of money that exists in that industry is true, well, I'll give it a crack. So I started and, you know, started speaking, and people paid, and that was how we built the first home, or my contribution to the building of the first home. And subsequently that became how I made a living, you know. And, you know, I've had moments and, you know, a real big turning point for me in, you know, that journey was I got invited to speak to a conference in San Francisco, and it was an Australian conference held by an organisation called NATA, which is the National Association Retail Traders of Australia, and it's a buying group, represents the members, so our retailers like Retrovision, Better Stores, Buy Right, Bing Lee, Good Guys, those kind of retailers, and then it represents the suppliers. You know, anyone that sells or manufactures, you know, white or brown goods that you have in your house, consumer electronics, they're part of it. So about 170 odd delegates in this conference, and pretty bloody flash conference, I'll give you the tip.
You would have fitted right in, mate.
Well, I don't know how much time we've got in this story, but I you know, that let me tell you this part of the story, right? I fly over to San Fran business class, you know.
Wow.
And first time in business class, and I'm thinking, you know, this is just a world I've never been in, you know. And I arrive and I'm there, like I'm still working full time for the police at this stage. I take a couple of days annual leave to fly to San Fran to speak at this international conference, and And I arrive and I'm so new to this speaking circuit, right? Been doing it long enough that they knew to reach out to me, invite me to their conference, but so naive about the whole conference and this beautiful flash hotel, you know. And anyway, I check in and, you know, I've been so excited on the way over. I've, you know, filled my boots full of free drink because that's what you do when you, when you've got it for the first time,
yeah,
you know.
What else? And, yeah, what else would you do? Yeah.
Yeah, can't, you know, don't sleep on the plane because I've got to watch every movie that I can because it's free. And and then, you know.
What are you, fucking 14 years old? What are you doing?
I was. Then I get to the hotel and I think, okay, well, it's, you know, now been 30 hours since I've had a sleep or whatever. So I think I better try and have a sleep. I've got to sleep tomorrow.
What could go wrong? Yeah.
So I lay in a bed and go, you know, 15 minutes later, go, okay, giving this up, I can't sleep. I'm in San Fran. You know, I've never been here before. So I get up and anyway. They send me an invite to formal drinks that evening, a networking session. And I'm an absolute introvert and I fucking hate that kind of stuff. And I know no one. So there's 170 people here. They all know each other. I know no one, right? So there's no way I'm going to this networking.
Yeah, fuck that. Yeah.
I go, not on your life. And I go, the first time I'll see you is when I do my AV check for the speaking gig the next morning. And so I'm dressed in a pair of runners and some jeans and a State of Origin footy shirt on, and I'm heading out to walk the streets of San Fran. And so I get to the lift and I see a lady there who's got a name tag and her name is Christine, and she's clearly from the conference. And I said to her, how are you enjoying the conference? And she looked at me and said, well, who are you? You know, dressed like a hobo and clearly Australian. Why aren't you at the conference and why aren't you going to this dinner? And I said, I'm speaking at the conference tomorrow morning. And she says to me, oh, you'll have to come to this networking drinks. I said, oh, no, I won't. And she goes, oh, yes, you will. And she loops her arm in through my arm and says, come with me. So we step into the lift. And I'm going, oh, holy shit, what's going on here? And I hit the ground floor. She hits the second floor and still have her arm looped around me. And she's dressed beautifully, you know, like, and the lift door was open.
Well, you're pretty fancy, mate. Let's be honest. You're fancy as fuck yourself.
Oh, absolutely. So
the
lift door is open and it's like bing, and it's, and everyone turns and it's probably imagining it worse than it was, but people turn. And out steps Christine Whipfley, who happens to be the chairman's wife.
Yeah,
and,
perfect.
On her arm is this bloke who looks like could have been caught stealing something from the hallway. Mm. And we walk in and she goes, oh, there you go. Welcome to the drinks. And people are looking going, who is this guy? Why is he with the chairman's wife? And why is he dressed like that? And she then just releases me into this swarm of people who are dressed to the nines and as fancy as all shit. And I'm standing there going, ah, oh, is there a hole that I can crawl into and die? And she goes, I'll get you a drink. And people are just looking at me going, who are you? So I just walked from the front of that room, and what I could see was an illuminated fire exit at the other end of the room. I made my beeline straight to that fire exit, out the door and down onto the street, gasping for breath, most terrifying moment of my life. I get out onto the street and I'm gone, you know, and I think, holy fuck, what happened there? And anyway, next morning I'm due to speak to these people, so I'm a bit more in my comfort zone because I've got the got my suit on and I'm in my knowing place, you know, and we go to breakfast and it's a breakfast because I'm all but closed. I'm the last speaker. And then they've got Sugar Ray Leonard, who's going to come on at the end of the conference and do his bit, right? So I'm one of the last speakers on the last day to close this conference out. And this morning they've got all the speakers. It's a breakfast for the speaker. So it's all these, you know, super motivated and big talking American speakers there. And I'm just this, you know, little Australian bloke going, well, I'm new to this. I'm sitting at the end of the table going, please don't ask me a question.
Just
please
a bogan from Sydney, mate.
Just let me eat my breakfast. Just don't ask me a question. And anyway, I get up and deliver this keynote presentation. And it goes over okay, you see. And what happens at the end of it, they have the panel of speakers up on stage, and I'm invited to join this panel. And this guy called Shane Leaney stands up in the audience during question time, and he says to me, he says, "Pete, you've spoken about this home you've built in Thailand." He said, "What are your current costs?" And at the time, they were 50 grand. They're 2.7 mil now, but I said 50 grand. He said, "All right, I'll put $250 on the table and I challenge everyone in the room to match it." And I said, "Fantastic. It's not really a question, it's a statement." So that's the end of it. So we kind of wrap up there, questions move on, and then Sugar Ray Leonard comes on and does his thing, and conference is called to a conclusion at lunchtime. Everyone adjourns for the formal dinner that night. So I'm off having lunch at the conference, and sitting on my own, not having a lot of chat with anyone, and then the CEO at the time, a lady by the name of Kay Spencer, came up to me and said, "You know that request that was made to put money on the table?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, it's gone up to $100,000. And I went, "Oh, holy shit," you know. And I went out that afternoon, and I reflected on the last couple of years, you know, of, you know, sleeping in hostels, living out of the boot of the car, the impact on, you know, my kids, my ex-wife, and you know, that whole journey. And I actually rang my ex-wife and just said, "You're not going to believe what's happened." And, you know, I've just been given $100,000 just on the back of a 60-minute story, you know.
Wow.
And, like, I didn't ask. There was no ask. There was no request. No one knew what was coming in this keynote, you know. And then we went to the dinner that night, and it was one of those occasions which, you know, it's so incredibly humbling, and, you know, it's a beautiful thing. And but it's, you know, that night there'd been enough time for people to digest the story that I never got to eat, because if people just walk up and want to talk to you and, you know, acknowledge what you've done. And then the chairman, he got up to speak that night, John Whipley, Christine's husband. And John stood up and he said, "We heard a great story today from a young guy doing a great thing, and you've responded as an industry." And he said that $100,000 has gone to $250,000. So I left the conference with a check for $250,000. And, you know, and got to the airport and opened my emails, and there was an email from the lady who was running our home in Banthan Nam Chai, the Thai lady who'd we'd set this up with. And she wrote to me and she said, "I've just been diagnosed with advanced and aggressive breast cancer. The public hospital, the wait to get in is such that I don't know that I'll survive." And she said, "Can you just continue to do what you do?" And I wrote back to her and said, "Well, here's the thing, Khun Ratchana. I've just been given $250,000. We're here to support you." You know, and that was the start of a journey with Nata, Kay Spencer, and an incredibly generous group of people, an amazing industry who don't do it for any praise, but have continued to support me. And it's closer to $500,000 a year that we receive from them. You know, they invited me back to speak at their conference in Whistler in 2009 to give them an update on what I'd done with the 250K. And the cool thing was, before I flew to Whistler, I'd been speaking that week. I spoke up at the Gold Coast for Lang O'Rourke, a construction company. You know, it was on the Saturday, and it was the convention center on the Gold Coast there. It's a big amphitheater. So you, as a speaker, you're on the floor, and then you're looking up to the audience, and you know, you can have, you know, 1,500 people, 2,000 people in there, but you can't see them because you've got the lights in your eyes, and you can just see, you know, the first 10 rows or so forth. And anyway, spoke at this conference and left, walked off stage. Another speaker Adam Spencer, the mathematician, he walked on and he was speaking, and I got in the car, back to the airport, flew back to Sydney, and that was on the Saturday. And on the Sunday, I got a phone call from the Speakers Bureau. Now, they don't ring you on a Sunday. And he rang me and he said, so I've heard from the client. And I go straight to the point of, fuck, how bad was it? You know, like I thought it kind of went over okay. And I go straight to that low self-esteem, big ego. And I go, you know, like, how bad was this? And he goes, no, no, no. He said, they want to meet you. And I go, seriously, Dave, you know, what's this about? And he said, no, listen, he said, you need to go and meet them. It's not bad. So a meeting is set up and I go in a couple of days later into the North Sydney office of Lang O'Rourke, where I'm to meet Ray O'Rourke, the chairman of the company, kind of a big deal, right?
Mm.
And so I meet and so I attend the foyer, sent up to the, you know, the 11th floor or so forth, get out, and you're now in the executive suite. And this guy walks over to me, and I'm at the second reception, and they say, yeah, shortly someone will be coming. And this older gentleman, pretty big fellow, walks out to me and he goes, g'day, Pete. And he grabs my hand, pulls me in for a bear hug, and he's punching me in the ribs like an uncle, you know?
Wow.
And this is Ray O'Rourke, the chairman of the organization.
Mm.
And he goes, you did a wonderful thing. He said, you're doing some great work. He goes, I've got something for you. And reaches into his pocket of his coat. And people around him go, no, not yet, Ray. Not yet. No, in front of the logo. Wait, Ray. And he goes, oh, that's all bullshit. And he goes, here you go, son. Hands me a check, $250,000.
God.
And so that week, that's on the Friday. I head straight to the international airport. Not because I've got a check for $250,000. I'm not fleeing the country, Craig, but I'm heading off to speak at NATA, right? And we're now in Whistler. So I fly over to Whistler, first night we arrive, there's formal drinks. Well, I'm going this time, aren't I?
And, of course you are.
They've happened to ship in a musician who's going to play for this conference. You might have heard of him. His name's called John Stevens. Had a bit of a band going around called Noiseworks. Right?
Yeah, I've heard of him. Yep. Yeah.
So
we've all heard of him. Yep.
It's an absolutely fucking legend of a guy. So we're then drinking cocktails in this executive suite, which is just for the VIPs of this conference, and end up back in John Stevens' room. There's four of us smoking cigars and drinking whiskey till a horrible time in the morning. And speak at this conference a couple of days later, and I leave there with $330,000 from NATA, and it's a journey that continued, and I've been incredibly privileged, as you can tell, from the places I've been able to go and people I've met and the experiences I've had, and importantly the money that we've raised and the change we've been able to bring about for these kids. And
mate, so when I said. When you finish, can you give us a snapshot of some of the things that you've done so people can get a context of where the money's going and what's happening with it?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I started Hands, and so it's Hands Across the Water, and Jill from the UK, she started with me, and it was her idea. And I said, well, you raise money in the UK, I'll raise it in Australia and we'll see how we go. And she did. She went about it in a traditional fundraising way of getting all her friends and family and held an event, and they gave money. Well, I'd split the sheets. So I had no friends and had no money. And so I raised the money through speaking. But what happened was I got the longevity. I continue today and we're raising more than we ever have. But so we built the first home, and that was all the ever idea. That was all we were ever going to do. And I thought, building my home, problem solved. And it wasn't until we were there for the opening of this first home for these 32 kids that I thought, well, what happens now? You know, now who looks after these kids? Where does the money come from? Who pays for the staff? Who pays for the upkeep? Who pays for the education? Who pays for the food and medicine? And I returned to Australia and I thought, well, this has really just begun. And then what happens in crisis and disaster? And I've worked in Japan, Indonesia, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, Australia, lots of people turn up. Governments, NGOs, charities, corporates, they all turn up in the early days, but too many leave too quickly.
Yeah.
And as I saw them pulling out of Thailand, well, there were these homes and centres that had been built and funded, which now had no money. And but the kids were there. The need hadn't gone away.
Yeah.
Their parents hadn't suddenly come back.
Yeah.
So we went from 32 to 64. So then we built another home. And then in 2010, I got introduced to a lady who was running a home at a place called Yosaton outside of Ubon Ratchathani in the northeast of Thailand. And she provided a home for kids who had HIV or who had lost their parents to HIV. And the very cruel thing was that kids were consistently dying up there because they didn't have access to the medicine that they needed.
Mm.
And she was deciding who basically would live and who would die through access to medicine.
Wow.
And she's buried 1,027 kids. You know, and I heard about this. I went and spent some time with her and got to understand the needs and what we could do. And we started giving her money and we started funding the entire operation, and something remarkable happened. The kids stopped dying, you know, and we transformed that place up there. We, you know, completely changed it. We now run and operate 7 centers across Thailand. And, you know, then we looked at, okay, well, what's our true measure of success? Because it's not in money. It's not in kids. It's not in buildings. You know, as a charity, you should be working to shut yourself down. You know, a charity doesn't, you know, celebrate growth. Growth just means the problem's still there. You haven't, you know, eliminated the problem. So we look at our success and say, well, how do we measure our success? And we look at it and say, what choices do the kids have when it comes time to leave our home? Mm. If they can live a life of choice rather than chance, well, that's success. So what does that mean in practical terms? Well, we've got 27 kids that we've fully funded in scholarships who have completed university degrees.
Amazing.
You know, one of our kids who came back and took the job of Khun Rotchana, who would end up losing a life to cancer many years after the first bout with breast cancer. He came back and took her job, and he runs the home he grew up in now. He's got a law degree. He's just graduated with his master's degree from Phuket University. You know, one of our girls who lost her entire family in the tsunami has no known living relative left in Thailand. She works in an advertising agency in Sydney. You know, she graduated with a marketing degree. She has no desire to return to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got 27 of these kids that have graduated from uni. But, you know, we also recognize that uni is not the be all and end all. So we build a digital learning center. And what we do with this learning center is we provide education that leads to employment as opposed to education that leads to qualifications. Because there's plenty of kids around here in Australia and Thailand, all around the world, who have studied at university. They graduate with a degree, a debt, and they're disillusioned. You know, they graduate and go, okay, I've got this degree in whatever it is. And they go, but there's no employment. Well, how do I get a job? You know, and so whilst we recognize uni's one option, we also recognize the, you know, a sustainable pathway forward is creating opportunities of employment that bring a quality of life and improved income to them.
Yeah.
So we provide industry-led training, working with industry who happen to employ our graduates because they've designed the training, we've delivered the training, and they give them jobs. You know, we have a hospitality training center down in the south, which will open once tourism returns. The biggest industry in the southern part of Thailand is hospitality and tourism. The biggest problem the hotels face, and these are the big branded hotels that you and I know about, the biggest problem they face is getting staff.
Mm.
Not good staff, just staff.
Wow.
So we worked with them and saying, well, what about if we provide, we run a hospitality training center, you design the training, we'll deliver the training, then you provide employment to our graduates. And they're climbing over themselves to be part of this because they can then get trained staff, you know. So this is part of what we do is we, you know, meet the immediate needs of the kids, We provide the education, we provide access to healthcare, but our big goal is providing that life of choice, not chance.
Mate, you're a good human being. Fuck, I love what you're doing. I love what you're doing. And in the middle of all of this, we need to wind up because I've got something else in 17 minutes. But in the middle of all of this, are you happy?
Absolutely, mate.
Good. Good. And do you see your kids much?
Not with lockdown. I've been locked out of Sydney for the past 3-4 months, whatever it is. So they're all in Sydney. I live on a farm 3 hours out of Sydney. But come Monday, I'll be heading to Sydney to see the kids.
Perfect. Now, how can people find you, follow you, and support Hands Across the Water and support your work?
Handsacrossthewater.org.au is where you find everything about hands, and then peterbaines.com.au is where you find all the stuff about me.
And you're not an Insta boy? You're not an Insta model, mate?
No, mate. I'm there, but all I post is photos of my cows and the paddocks. It's a pretty boring Instagram account.
What about Burton the Wonder Dog?
Oh, he's a wonderful dog. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do you know he's got a dog called Burton, Tiff?
No.
Fucking research. Why research?
Do you know why he's called Burton? How good your research, Craig?
Oh, fuck. Give me a break. after Tim Burton movies? I don't know.
Wrong.
All right. I
was on the piss with my wife in a sake bar in Japan when we knew we were going to get Burton. And we're mad snowboarders, and our brand of snowboard is Burton. And we went, well, what better way to bring him into the snowboarding family than to name him Burton?
Well, mate, I'm not the fucking detective. You're the detective, dude. So
there you go.
Fucking hell. Hey, we appreciate you being on the U Project. You're a great man. And, like, thank you so much for all the awesome work you do. And you're an inspiration. And I'd love to get you back. I'd love to get you back again and have another chat. But stay there. We'll say goodbye to everyone, then goodbye to you off air. Good work, Tiff.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. That was so good to hear so much more detail about what you've done.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Love your guts. See you next time.